From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the sixth day of August 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. And later in this half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Bruce Bostard. He's the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. In agricultural news, USDA could soon have more regulatory power over school lunches. America's bakers are not happy about the skyrocketing price of wheat, and Chuck Grassley has a little conversation about ethanol with the administrator of US EPA. All the details in a few minutes. And then in the second half hour of our program on many of these stations and always online at willag.org, we'll hear this week's edition of In My Backyard with Lisa Braltz, explore a corn disease called Southern Corn Rust, and hear again from Chris Hurt. Today, food be fuel. And it all happens on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
In Chicago, on this Friday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby September wheat at $7.25¾, down 60. December at $7.55¼, 60 lower. And the March at $7.58, down 60 cents as well. Next year's July soft red winter wheat at $7.03, 59½ cents lower. In Kansas City, nearby contract at $7.20, finished down 60. September corn futures, $4.05, a penny and a half higher. December at $4.20, up 2. March at $4.33, 3 higher, and the May futures at $4.41, up 4¼. July corn, $4.48 for next year, up 5¼. And next year's December 2011 contract at $4.40½, up 6 cents. August soybean futures, $10.59, 4 higher. September, $10.39, up 4¼. And November beans at $10.33½, up 4½ cents. January futures, $10.39½, up 5¼. The March contract at $10.41, up 5¾. From the bean meal pit, August contract at $3.13.60, unchanged. August soybean oil at $41.39, up 13 on the afternoon. August live cattle futures, $92.77½, 12½ cents lower. The October at $95.50, down 77½. August feeders at $112.40, down 30. The SEPs at $112.25, 42½ lower. And the August lean hogs at $82.02, down $1.77½. This is the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil, September contract, $80.81, down $1.21 a barrel. Ethanol at $1.72¾, that's a penny and 9 cents lower. Natural gas at $4.47¼, down 12½ cents. And the heating oil at $2.15, down 3�6 cents a gallon. Gold futures at $1,203.40, a gain today of $6.20. The Dow at 10,594 is down just about 80 points. And the dollar at 80.4 is down 0.42. The CRB index at 274.71 now is currently trading down 2.96 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast looks like for the immediate area in east central Illinois. Skies this afternoon should be sunny, high of near 84, northwest winds around 9 miles an hour. It's 81 degrees now outside the studios here in Urbana-Champaign. Tonight, mostly clear skies, a low of 60, north-northwest winds between 4 and 7 miles an hour. Saturday, sunny, high near 86, calm winds becoming westerly, about 6 miles an hour. And then Saturday night, mostly clear, a low around 64, winds out of the northwest at 6 miles an hour, then becoming out of the southeast. And then on Sunday for the rest of the weekend, sunny skies, high near 90, south-southwest winds between 6 and 10 miles an hour. Sunday night, mostly clear, with a low around 70 degrees. The extended forecast says Monday will be sunny with a high of 94, Monday night partly cloudy and a low of 72. Tuesday, mostly sunny and hot, a high near 96. Tuesday night, 73 degrees with a low and partly cloudy. It'll get sunny again on Wednesday with a high near 93. And Wednesday night should be about 71 degrees with a low. More on the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour. And we talk with Steve Hilberg from NOAA's Midwestern Regional Climate Center.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Support comes from Taylor & Martin Auctions, which is holding an auction of over 100 pieces of large late-model ag equipment from John Deere, Case, and Cat on Tuesday, August 10th at 10 a.m. at Progress City in Decatur, Illinois. Online bidding is available at tmilive.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. On the phone line with us to take a look at what happened in Chicago is Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Good afternoon, Todd. How are you today?
Oh, you know, when you get up really high, don't look over the edge because it is a long, fast fall usually, and that happened in the wheat pit today, down 60. What happened?
Well, I think probably this is one of those times where you just physically ran out of longs. It was interesting because Thursday, when we were moving sharply higher, I talked to some of the people in Chicago, and they said one of the biggest things that was happening in their deck anyway was that hedgers were lifting out of their short positions, buying back their hedges because they didn't want to feed the margin man. And I think that is very reminiscent of what we had to deal with in 2007, 2008, when you had hedgers not wanting to feed the margin man in that time period. And those are the people that are usually the tightest holders of their positions, Todd. So when you get to that point, I think you probably have a vacuum of buyers. No one's really there to take on the long side or take on the short side, I should say. And so when you want to buy at this point, you just can't follow through because you have that lopsided trade. And I think that's probably what today was about, because one of the things I've got a list of eight things that usually happen when you get towards the top end of a market and you need to see a significant pullback. You got record volume trade in Europe. You had news plastered all over the TV about the wheat for the last 48 hours. You had funds reportedly record long around 84,000 contracts of Chicago wheat. You had basis widening here in the Gulf on this rally this week. You've had implied volatility on some of these options running almost 62% for September wheat options. Hedgers were lifting these hedges. You had confirmation of the Russian exports being banned. And then the exchange raised their margins this morning. So you go through all those and you can see pretty easily that the market is probably needing to set back and fill the vacuum and maybe suck in some more new longs.
And then, of course, on the export ban, I think, and maybe I got this wrong, but I picked up that at least there's some discussion inside Russia that maybe this is not the right thing to do, although it appears it's at least in place until mid-October.
You know, this is the ugly part of export bans and embargoes, is that you have no question, you've got wholesale flour prices have doubled since the 1st of April in the Moscow region. Cereal prices are up 80% in the Urals. Sugar's up 12% to 25%. Rice prices are up by a third. So there is no question that grocers are paying anywhere from 15% to 20%, 15% to 60% more from wholesalers for their grocery items, and they're worried about having to pass that on. So there's no question that ban probably needed to be put in place, but the longevity of it is the big question, because the Russian cancellation was as much about protecting and allowing those exporters to default on contracts without penalty as it was about protecting the domestic supplies and curbing these price rallies and this inflation. So I think that's where your point's really well taken, is that do we really need to have this type of embargo when the harvest so far is 37 million tons versus 39 last year? That doesn't seem so bad right now, does it? So I think that's where the trade probably wanted to go home with some profit in their pockets and reevaluate over everything over the weekend and get some fresh news.
Yeah, well, speaking of the fresh news, what have we been able to glean, and I guess that's the right word, isn't it, for wheat? But what have we been able to capture from Russia, from Kazakhstan, from Ukraine, about the size of that wheat crop? NPR reported at one point that some of it was burning even because it was so very dry. I have my doubts about how much of that would happen on the here. You'd try to stop that fairly quickly, but if it was dry, it would run fast, I suppose.
Well, one of the stories that was circulating around the floor before the opening, and probably why we had a higher opening in wheat, or one of the reasons was because planes were being diverted out of Moscow because of the smog and the pollution and the lack of air flow because of this drought. You had people walking around with masks on and things like that. So you are getting kind of a fever pitch mindset. But I think to answer your question, the germane point comes back to the USDA report, because we had the International Grain Council, the Foreign Agricultural Office from the FAO from the United Nations, and Informa all came out with right around the 650 to 651 world production number, and that's after all these amounts of declines. I came out with a fresh number this week at around 636 million tons as far as world production. If you come out with a 636 to 640, you're still talking about 24% stocks to use. That's still ample, and like Cargill said, I think it was Cargill on Thursday in a Newswire was quoted that this is still a regional problem, not a global problem, and I think that's where we head next week is how much upside do we have in the wheat after correcting? Do we suck in more new longs, and do we have fresh news that says from USDA we're worse than 24% stocks to use? We're actually back down in that 18-19% level like we were in 06 and 07. That's when you can probably continue on higher in Ernst.
All right, so I was looking at some of the numbers on the weekly trade, and I suppose for this year there might be some storage left, but I wonder about that. So let's deal with July of next year and a crop that folks might be putting in ground yet this fall for wheat. On June the 7th, I have or the week of June the 7th, 540 low, and we finished at 703, and it was down 7.25 cents this week.
Yes, and we had I think a high of around 785 or 795 in that new crop wheat. So at some point this week, we could have even with a 70 or 80 cent basis for fall for the July delivery off the combine delivery could have still been over $7 cash. And I have heard from many clients in Illinois and Indiana for that matter that corn on corn areas of Illinois, mind you, that they're out of seed as far as wheat seed at this stage. So we are buying acres here, and that matches up with why do we need to rally right now? Well, it's not just because of the old crop supply tightness, but we want to secure northern hemisphere new crop supplies as well, and in the form of producers going out there and planting fence row to fence row on wheat.
Have they been able to sell the cash for
next year? Have. Yeah, they really have. You know, the variable storage interest, the variable storage rate coming up, I think a client near Tuscola told me this morning that 3 weeks ago, the wheat price was about 40 under. Now it's slipped to 90 under with this rally. So they've probably tapered off in terms of selling cash at these higher price levels. But the last couple, 3 weeks, they've had some pretty good prices to sell.
Okay, so let's turn our attention to corn and soybeans. Despite the heavy losses today in the wheat pit, corn and beans managed to put gains in, although there were some double-digit losses there for a while in the corn pit.
Yeah, we almost went negative in the corn. And you know, the interesting thing about the corn and beans is that we're still trading supply. And you could see that yesterday when we had the private surveys come out with bigger yields in both corn and beans. And that was one of the major factors, along with some farmer selling and hedge pressure, took us negative on the day, really surprised a lot of the traders. But then we finished higher today on the weather. The weather's turning very hot, very dry. Evansville, Mount Carmel, Princeton, Indiana, some of the models are saying 104, 105 degrees next week, and that may not move off to the east or back down to the south anytime soon. So I think the bean weather market is still very much alive and well, but it is interesting because Thursday and Friday showed us we're not trading demand yet. We're still trading supply going into this report next Thursday.
Okay. Any final word before I let you go?
You just have a great weekend, sir.
Hey, you too. Thanks much, Mike.
Thanks, Todd.
Mike Zuzulo is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. He's in Lafayette, Indiana. You can hear him again if you'd like on our website. The address is WILLAG.org. Back in a moment with the agricultural news for the afternoon.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
In today's agricultural news this week, Iowa Senator Tom Harkin introduced an amendment to the pending energy bill with a bipartisan group of senators that would provide for expansion of the U.S. biofuels market. The bill would increase the percentage of flex fuel vehicles manufactured in the United States, increase the number of blender pumps at refueling stations for increased access to higher ethanol blends, and authorize loan guarantees for renewable fuel pipelines. In regard to the percentage of vehicles made flex fuel capable, the amendment requires 50% of the vehicles to be so in 2013 and 2014, and 90% in 2015 and beyond. And that does not include electric vehicles. Well, U.S. ethanol production is at a record high. According to the Energy Information Administration, or the EIA, U.S. ethanol producers hit a record high for daily production for the week ending July the 30th. During that period, ethanol production averaged 873,000 barrels a day, or more than 36.6 million gallons daily. And while the ethanol production increased, gasoline demand for that same week fell to just over 398 million gallons per day. As a percentage of daily gasoline demand, daily ethanol production is 9.21%. That's the highest recorded since EIA began publishing the weekly ethanol data. Wheat prices have some bakers concerned. U.S. wheat prices, as you already know, exploded to two-year highs on Russia's export ban yesterday, and the market volatility has bakers worried. Stuart Doan of the National Association of Farm Broadcasting reports.
U.S. wheat prices have gained over $3 a bushel since the end of June. The American Bakers Association blames what it calls the dramatic increase in market volatility on index funds. Hayden Wands, chairman of ABA's Commodity and Ag Policy Committee, presented the bakers' concerns to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
In the last 30 days, we've seen a 60% increase in our flour prices due to the volatility. And over the last 24 hours, we've seen a 15% increase in our flour prices due to the volatility of the marketplace. So it has caused us to drastically re-examine how we hedge our positions.
The ABA wants the CFTC to impose position limits on index funds, treating them as traditional speculators rather than hedgers. I'm Stuart Doan reporting.
And finally today, the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, legislation to reauthorize federal child nutrition programs through 2015, was passed unanimously in the Senate yesterday. The bill calls for over $3 billion to improve the nutritional quality of school meals. It also gives USDA the authority to regulate all foods on all school campuses, which goes beyond their existing authority to regulate only meals served through the National School Lunch Program. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Please do visit us online at willag.org. There you can hear our flagship program for the week. It's called Commodity Week, a look back at what happened in the marketplace. Our guest this week, Craig Parr of the Andersons out of Maumee, Ohio. Now, up next, you know many senators, including Iowa GOP Senator Chuck Grassley, met with EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson earlier this week. Jackson confirmed to them that higher blends of ethanol will not be ready to sell to consumers, even if approved this fall, that until early next year. Grassley said the fact is disappointing since the administration claims to be a friend of renewable fuels. Ethanol blend testing is conducted by the Energy Department and should be done within a month or two, according to Grassley, but then it will head to the EPA for a final decision. EPA and Department of Energy officials were not able to explain why they are only considering the approval of higher ethanol blends in vehicles from 2001 and up. Grassley calls that disappointing, too, mentioning he owned a 1964 Oldsmobile in which he used ethanol for most of the 20 years he owned it.
Several of us asked questions about, well, what's magic about 2001? What about 1998, 99, 2000? We really didn't get answers to those questions.
But the senators did get an answer from Administrator Jackson on why the testing is taking so long.
They know they're going to be sued by oil, by small engine companies, by environmentalists, by an odd coalition, even beyond the three aspects of it I named. And she needs plenty of evidence so that they aren't successfully sued and overruled by the courts. And that's what she's trying to do.
Grassley says Jackson told senators a lawsuit is inevitable, and the best evidence and science the EPA can have and the information on what E15 might do to engines is the best way of getting it done.
I sense that they just want to be certain when they make a rule that the courts don't overrule it, and that they're just going to be very, very cautious in that approach, and that they're nearing a point where they're going to be making positive announcements for ethanol, but also being sued.
Well, even if the EPA is sued, Grassley says Jackson does not expect that to halt the rule.
I think she was positive that the rule would go into effect, not be stayed, and that we would be able to market E15 while the suit's going on and hopefully win the lawsuit.
According to Grassley, there were some good outcomes from the meeting.
Despite these concerns, it was good to hear positive statements. And these positive statements that were made were in regard to testing and blending of gasoline with even 20% ethanol.
Grassley says testing for 20% blends is happening too, and the Energy Department has indicated those tests could be done around the same time as the testing on 15% blends. Knowing that, Grassley suggests it might be time for the ethanol industry to get out a petition for 20% blends.
Turn it up.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. Time to check the cash grain market. On the phone line with us today, Bruce Bostard. He's with the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Bruce.
Good afternoon.
It's been a wild ride in the wheat market the last few days. Have you had producers that have decided, well, it's time to put a little wheat in the ground and they want to make a sale for next year?
We have bought some new crop wheat out there. I think our seed department has sold a bunch of additional wheat that's going to go into ground this year. I've had several people say they're changing their planting intentions and maybe on a little more marginal ground be pushing in some additional acres in wheat. So we've seen quite a bit of interest out there. I've seen a little bit of interest in summer 2012 crop. We're not bidding that far out. the basis is wide enough, has really backed off this week in response to the board going wild. We've seen, a 40-cent basis move in 2 days on wheat, and not the good way.
Yeah, so you're at what, 90 cents? How wide are you?
We're 90 under. We went from 50 under to 75 to 90 in a two-day period out there, so some wild changes. I think 2008 is a little bit too fresh in people's memory on how the board took off and ran, and the cash market said, that's fine, go. We're not going to participate right now.
You have any calls on corn or beans today?
Some today. We bought a little bit. Yesterday, of course, was a pretty active day. Apparently, there was more old crop beans out there than I thought there was because we bought a chunk of them. So.
That surprised you. Were you the only one? Did you call around? Did other elevators have the same
experience? I haven't talked to anybody else to see, but very rarely do you stand out there as a lone ranger. Usually the same thing happens pretty generally.
How wide is your basis now on corn and beans?
Corn, we're at 23 under on nearby. New crop at 34 under. Not a whole lot of change. That's lost 2 to 3 cents through the course of the week. And you get out to March, it's actually about 2-3 better. So we've put some more carry into the corn. Beans have lost 5 cents nearby and new crop and gained a penny in the March. So we are 40 over for August, new crop at 30 under, March at 29 under.
All right, and your actual bids?
We are 382 nearby corn, 386 for new crop, beans 1074 and 1004.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bruce Bostard is with the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company. He's in Ludlow, Illinois, manages the elevator there, joins us on a Friday afternoon here on the Closing Mark Report. In just 2 minutes, we'll take a look at the agriculture weather forecast. Steve Hilberg is the director of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center that belongs to NOAA.
It's National Waffle Day. It's also National Mustard Day. At first, mustard was considered a medicinal plant. In ancient times, the Greeks used mustard as a remedy for scorpion stings. Prepared mustard for culinary purposes may date back to the early Romans, who ground mustard seeds and mixed them with wine into a paste. On this day in agricultural history in 1855, William Dimes was born. An English meteorologist, he was the first to invent an instrument to measure both the velocity and direction of wind. In 1909, the first corporation tax was passed by the U.S. Congress. In 1914, the first electric traffic lights were installed in Cleveland, Ohio, at Euclid Avenue and East 105th Street. And in 1962, Marilyn Monroe died, an American actress. In 1947, she won a curious contest. She was crowned the first artichoke queen of Castroville, California. The little-known Hollywood starlet, born Norma Jean Baker, had just begun using Marilyn Monroe as her name, although she did not legally change her name until 1956, just 6 years before she died. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
Listening to the Closing Mark Report on a Friday afternoon from Illinois Public Media at the Urbana-Champaign campus in Urbana from the U of I. On the phone line with us this afternoon, Steve Hilberg. He's the director of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center. That belongs to NOAA. Good afternoon to you, Steve.
Good afternoon, Todd.
It is just a gorgeous day. And boy, 82 degrees feels really good outside.
Yeah, and what even makes it better is dew points are down around 60, actually in the upper 50s in some locations, but that's a long way from what we were just on Tuesday with dew points in the upper 70s and even low 80s in some spots along with the heat. So this is a huge improvement over what we had earlier in the week, and looks like we'll be able to keep it for a couple of days, too.
What will our weekend look like?
Well, actually, tomorrow looks very much like today. It'll be a couple degrees warmer and should still continue to be generally dry as far as the humidity is concerned. But on Sunday, we'll start to see the heat increase. The weak high-pressure system that's over us now will be drifting east, and the winds will start to swing back into a southerly component. And that'll bring some of that hot air back in here, so that by Sunday, we'll probably be up around 90 and probably getting into the 90s here in the early part of next week with also a gradual return in humidity levels as well.
Will we be as hot and humid as we were? Or?
I think we, as far as temperatures are concerned, we could be approaching somewhat we had earlier this week. I don't think we're going to see any hundreds this week like we did in southern Illinois early in the week, but I think 90s, possibly mid-90s, could be prevalent the first part of next week. But as has been the case the last couple of weeks, it seems like every weekend brings another cold front, which is nice, and it does look like there will be another one swinging down through here by the end of next week. And that might actually mark the beginning of a longer-term cool down. You know, we won't just be a day or two. It could be more of a pattern change a little bit starting next weekend. But jury's still out on that, but it's been looking promising.
Look back at the month of July. How did it turn out for the state of Illinois?
Well, actually, July was not that bad of a month when you look at the weather as a whole. We had temperatures were warmer than normal, but not very much so. They generally range from about a degree above normal along the Mississippi River to 2 in the eastern half of the state. What was really remarkable was the persistent high dew points we had the last 3 or 4 weeks, which, you know, with the heat index, you add that humidity to the temperature, and it makes it feel a lot hotter than it was. So July as a whole was not bad temperature-wise. It was pretty reasonable. In terms of precipitation, that was a little bit all over the place. There were some areas that got plenty of rain and others that did not get that much. There's a little spot up there around I-80, LaSalle County, that tended to be a dry spot, as did far southern Illinois, with a lot of rain in northern Illinois and far western Illinois. And roughly along 50, 60 miles either side of I-70, rainfall was above normal to normal. So it was a pretty patchwork picture in July.
Thanks so much for being with us.
All right, Todd.
Mm-hmm. Steve Hilberg is the director of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center. Belongs to the Illinois State Water Survey and NOAA, right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. Stay with us if you can for the farming world. It comes up next, or you can listen to it online at willag.org.
Support comes from Taylor & Martin Auctions, which is holding an auction of over 100 pieces of large late-model ag equipment from John Deere, Case, and Cat on Tuesday, August 10th at 10 a.m. at Progress City in Decatur, Illinois. Online bidding is available at tmilive.com.
This is the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're talking with Purdue Extension ag economist Chris Hurt this afternoon about beef and livestock supplies in the United States. Mr. Hurt, when we had previously in our conversation discussed why it was that supply of beef had contracted, why prices were so difficult for producers to get, it was in large part because the input cost, the feed supply, the corn price in particular, bean meal as well, were very high. That happened in 07, 08, 09. You suggest now that they can afford to pay the $4 price for corn. I'm wondering, though, whether some might take this as a food versus fuel debate and use it to say, well, we really don't have enough corn supply on the planet in the United States to manage all of our needs. Do you think that's true or not?
Well, certainly we did have extreme prices in 2008. We've ratcheted up, somewhat near double the prices that we would have had prior to 2006. Now, the cause for all of that, I think most people would say that there were multiple factors that were going on that caused such a rapid increase. We had very strong world economic growth, and of course that terminated in 2009 instead of growth economically, a recession. So that really, we had that strong demand. We had some poor crops around the world in 2005, 2006 that led to tightening of supplies. We had a weak dollar. And, of course, we also had the world in 2006, 2007 aggressively pursuing biofuels policies to take certainly some grains and oil seeds and convert them from primarily food uses over to fuel. So I think it was one of the primary factors. We don't want to say it was the only factor. What we have since that time is we've restored yields generally have been good. We have put some more land in production around the world, so there has been a supply response. We have increased the level of technology and inputs going into the cropping sector, and our technology has allowed yields to increase along trend lines that are positive. So we're coming into better balance, I think, of overall production of grains and oil seeds to meet both food and fuel. And certainly the corn growers and soybean growers said, just give us a chance. If the market is there, the demand for these grains, we can meet that. We can't meet it in 1 or 2 years. And so I think we'll go back and look at that rapid increase in 2006, 2007, 2008 in biofuels and say that, yes, the ag production sector of the world can meet both food and fuel, but that came very, very rapidly along with several other factors that created very strong consumption of grains. So what we have to have is a balance. We have to have a balance between what we can produce and those consumption uses, and I think we're coming better into balance. For one reason, biofuels, the increase in the amount of corn, as an example, we use for ethanol, that additional amount each year is now much smaller than it was back in 2006, 7, and 8.
So the free market has come into some balance. And then as you look out, let's talk about the future for the livestock. And in particular for the beef cattle producer, you suggested that by 2012 times might be better for them?
Well, and I think what we're seeing already is we've seen a return this starting this spring to some profitability for feedlot operators for finishing cattle. We have substantially better calf prices for the brood cow sector. And while those calf prices probably aren't high enough to cause people to retain more beef cows, they're at least covering all of their cost at this point. We don't see any expansion yet coming in beef. So that tells us that we cannot have more beef supply. It'll be less in 2011. That means we'll have more than likely a continuation of at least levels that will cover all the cost and maybe some profitability. Now, it will be that profitability that eventually may cause the beef industry to move into expansion. But at this point, we don't expect that expansion to show up at all in the brood cow sector until the middle part of 2011. It brings us out to about 2013 before we can see beef supplies to the consumer start to increase. So we have, I think, multiple years, 3 to 5 years of overall favorable returns for the beef sector. So retaining ownership on beef cows looks to me to be certainly a great strategy at this point.
And then on the retail side, what can consumers expect to see in the meat case as far as prices might go?
Well, we really have had, I think, the benefits, you know, on the consumption side of relatively low meat prices for the last couple of years. And what we're now saying for consumers is that the higher prices of meat are occurring now, and we're going to continue to see those, particularly for beef and pork, all the way through the rest of 2010 and all the way through 2011. So in a sense, consumers have not quite yet had to pay for some of the implications of the high feed prices, but we will be paying for that as consumers in the last half of this year and in 2011 and probably 2012.
That was Purdue Extension Ag Economist Chris Hurt on food and fuel. Let's turn our attention now to corn production and southern corn rust. We'll talk with plant pathologist Carl Bradley. First, tell me about rust in particular in corn. And I suppose it's a disease problem we usually hear about, Asian soybean rust, but there's wheat rust and all kinds of things. What is a rust?
There's different fungal pathogens that can cause rust diseases. And typically anything that is a rust produces a pustule that you can see on the leaf or whatever part of the plant it's causing a symptom on. So rusts are always airborne. They always have airborne spores, and a lot of these rusts don't overwinter here in Illinois and are blown up during the season, such as the case with soybean rust and then also with things like southern corn rust, which really what we're going to focus on today.
Speaking of that one, you said we're going to focus on it, and indeed we are. This is something that producers in the state of Illinois probably haven't ever seen before?
We've seen it before. It generally shows up late enough where it doesn't cause too big of a problem, although in the last couple of years, it has shown up down in southern Illinois, and in fact, it has shown up in some of my fungicide trials I've had at Dixon Springs down in Pope County in the southeastern part of the state, as well as over in Belleville over in the southwestern part of the state. And in those trials where it has shown up early enough, we've seen differences of anywhere between 5 and 30 bushel an acre differences between treated and untreated with the fungicide. So it can be a severe problem. It just has to show up early enough in the growth stage that it would still cause yield loss. So I think for this year, any late planted corn would especially be some that you'd want to target and scout for.
Can you follow the progression of it northward this year and where it's been and where it's likely to go?
You can somewhat. There is a pilot program that's going on now, similar to what we've done with soybean rust, with sentinel plots, and you can go to a website and track that disease. There's some states participating in a pilot program monitoring southern corn rust, and if someone were to go to the website www.ipmpipe.org, that's called the IPM pipe, and that would take you to the main page, and you can see things like soybean rust, and you can also go to the southern corn rust, and you can find that it's been reported in Kentucky and Arkansas and some other states to the south, and most recently, last week, we did find it in Illinois.
How far north?
We have found it as far north as Whiteside County, Bureau County,
all the way north.
Surprisingly, we haven't observed it in from our observations, we haven't seen it in southern Illinois, but I guarantee it is in southern Illinois as well, just because of where it's been found in Kentucky. And we just haven't looked in the right spot, but it's present in southern Illinois, I'm sure.
Why is it economically important?
Almost every hybrid planted is susceptible to southern rust, and that's why lots of times when we talk about rust on corn, people are thinking about common rust. And most hybrids that we plant have good resistance to common rust. Common rust has been around this year. That's not a disease that we typically think is economically important in our typical yellow dent hybrid corn. But southern rust can be a problem just because there's no resistance. Now, I think it's important that people be able to tell the difference between common and southern just because of the differences in their ability to cause yield loss. And so southern rust and common rust can look similar. One of the ways to tell them apart is to just look at the pustules themselves on the leaves. With common rust, the color of the pustules are going to be more of a cinnamon, sort of a cinnamon brown colored. Whereas with southern rust, the pustules are going to look much more orange colored. The pustules are going to be smaller with southern rust. And then the other thing with southern rust is the pustules are typically going to be on the upper side of the leaf, whereas with common rust, you can find it on both the upper and underside of the leaf. And so, and if you really are having problems, I think it's important to maybe to send some samples to the University of Illinois Plant Clinic. There's also some resources that are available. Last week, I wrote an article in the Bulletin that sort of outlined some of the differences. And there's a really good publication that came out from the University of Illinois about 5 years ago called A Field Guide to Corn Diseases. And Don White and Dean Malvick and Aaron Hager had put that publication together. And that is still available through PubS Plus from the U of I. So I think that's another good resource that one could go to and look at differences between the two diseases.
It does enough damage that producers need to treat for it, or can do enough damage that producers need to treat for it, or do they just need to be aware that it's there?
Well, both. It's important just for them to be able to identify it, so in case they do run into this disease in any future years, that they can recognize what it is. I think as far as treating for it, it really depends on where you are on your growth stage. Now, if you were able to get your corn in timely, planted in late April, I'm guessing that you're far enough along now, you're probably at dent stage or maybe past that, that you probably don't need to treat at this point in time. It's probably not going to cause enough economic damage. But if you did have some late planted fields, it's important to keep an eye on those and watch for southern rust. If it does appear, anywhere if you're at milk stage or before, you might be at a stage where it can still cause some yield loss, and so you may want to consider spraying a fungicide if southern rust is showing up. Another difference between southern and common rust is that common rust doesn't do very well in warm temperature, whereas southern rust can do very well in warm temperature. So this environment that we're going to have here this upcoming week, we're supposed to be very humid, very hot, and so those are the type of conditions that are very good for this particular disease.
When you scout for it, how much needs to be there before you pull the trigger on spraying?
Unfortunately, we don't have real solid economic thresholds. So we know that every hybrid is susceptible. So if you're seeing some levels on there prior to milk stage, you may want to consider making an application just because we know that it will continue to spread under the right environmental conditions. So it's important to be able to recognize southern rust and be able to tell it apart from common rust, especially.
That's plant pathologist from the University of Illinois, Carl Bradley. You're listening to The Farming World.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Bob Baisdiffer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
If you get the opportunity, make sure you visit our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. And listen to Commodity Week. We'll record at 4:30 this afternoon. Posted to the website by about 6 o'clock, our guest, Craig Parr of the Andersons in Maumee, Ohio. Here's a snapshot of what the numbers look like on the weekly trade this week. The September wheat had a settlement price at $7.25¾. The weekly trade was up 64¼. July of next year, down 7¼ at $7.03. The weekly trade for the corn, week to week, 405 in the September. Settlement price, 12¼. Higher December, 13¼ cents. Higher Friday to Friday at $4.20. Soybeans, a 10.59 settlement price in the August contract, up 6¼ on the week. And November beans at 10.33½. Up 28½. Live cattle futures settled the August contract week to week at 92.77½, up $2.07½. The feeders at 112.40 were down $1.32½. And the lean hog futures on the week settled at $82.02½, down $3.80. Be sure to listen to Commodity Week. You can find it online at willag.org after 6 o'clock this evening.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Hi, this is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Up next, bees and honey go together like bread and butter. But the bee has a huge role beyond producing something sweet, one that has huge implications for the backyard and commercial gardener alike. Lisa Brautz explores all things bees in her latest edition of In My Backyard.
My cucumbers have been a massive disappointment this garden season. The plants don't look all that healthy. There are way more male flowers than female flowers. And the female flowers, which supposedly bear the fruit, they're not. It could be this summer's heat. It could be a bad set of seeds. And I do admit to some benign neglect. But it could also be a lack of pollinators, specifically bees, in my part of the neighborhood. See, I need pollinators to come into my backyard and move pollen around from plant to plant, thus nudging my food-producing plants into, well, producing food. But actually, we all need pollinators to do their thing, because if they didn't, it would be a huge problem, agriculturally speaking. Bees have been on the decline for the past several decades for many reasons, but in 2006, the decline sped up. We started hearing about colony collapse disorder, a bizarre phenomenon where entire populations of adult bees would just disappear and die off for no apparent reason, leaving behind the hive's queen, unhatched bees, and food stores. This wasn't happening only in some far-off land either. This was, and still is, happening in the United States, wiping out entire colonies of bees in some states. Experts still don't really know what causes it. The appearance of colony collapse disorder shed new light on the practice of commercial beekeeping, of course, and how large-scale keeping of bees can affect large-scale agriculture. But it also dovetailed with the burgeoning interest nationally in local food, gardening, and related DIY projects. Robbie Nagel keeps bees in Urbana, where his friend J.P. Gogan lives, a large house backed up onto a few acres in a huge garden not far from downtown.
It goes along with a resurgence in local food systems and people saying that they want their own gardens. This is sort of the next step, because honeybees and pollinators are so important for a lot of our food. So it goes along, people say, oh, I want a garden, I have a garden, that's great. And then people say, oh, okay, now my garden needs to be pollinated, and what can do that? Honeybees.
Robbie's grandfather kept bees for 30 years as a hobby. When he decided to get out of it, Robbie asked for all of his beekeeping equipment so he could learn how. Just like when I asked my grandmother to send me all of her old wooden knitting needles after she gave up knitting. Robbie's grandfather, like my grandmother, was happy to give him the tools he needed. In Robbie's case, those included hives and frames, a bee smoker, and some bee tools. He even gave Robbie a few bee suits and hats and veils. You have to wear this stuff if you want to deal with bees. And even then, there's no guarantee you won't get stung. Lately, I've been wondering if I should add a hive to my backyard situation, what with all my spare time and lack of cucumbers, so I decided to pay Robbie and JP a visit to see what it entails. After a short interview, Robbie invited me to suit up. I asked him to describe what that means.
Yeah, for us it means a full suit, head to toe, with a veil and gloves. And some beekeepers don't wear veils. I've seen that before. Some beekeepers don't wear gloves. I've seen that before. This is only my going on my second year, so I prefer the full suit and veil until I get more comfortable with it.
Right. I opted for the suit. It wasn't the best day to check on bees. It was hot and overcast, and there was a stiff breeze. JP, who takes care of the bees when Robbie's not around, was working the smoker. Smoking the bees in their hive disrupts their communication with each other and causes them to eat a bunch of honey, which calms them down. That allows the beekeepers to do their work, and in JP's case, forego the bee suit. Today, Robbie was pulling frames out of the hive to check for honey, and he was impressed with the results.
I put this honey super on 2 weeks ago. It was completely empty, just nothing on there, brand new. And,
oh, wow, it's already capped.
They've drawn it out. We call that snow white comb because it's brand new. The comb can get dirty as the bees walk on it more. And, this looks really nice. I'm really surprised that they were able to do this in a couple of weeks.
I learned from Robbie and JP that keeping bees in a residential urban area is actually really good for the bees and good for making honey, thanks to the huge variety of plants that are grown by people in their gardens. Outside of town, where people grow lots and lots of one or two things, there isn't as much in the way of plant diversity for the bees. Bees can also be harmed by crop dusting in rural areas, so keeping them in town might be safer for them too. The one thing urban dwellers wanting to keep bees might have to reckon with, though, is neighbors. Fortunately, JP's neighbors and housemates are cool with it. Beekeeping culture is alive and well in Urbana-Champaign, too, with the Central Eastern Illinois Beekeepers Association around for assistance, education, and inspiration for bee geeks of all ages, even those who don't have their own bees. They can use this informal network to share equipment and advice and mentor each other, too. Maybe it's not the same as having a grandpa show you the ropes, but it helps. I might decide to go for it if I can clear it with my family and the neighbors. Yep, I've scoped out the perfect location for a hive in my backyard. Stay tuned.
Lisa Brott's stories can also be heard on our website, WILLAG.org. Click on the In My Backyard link in the right navigation window. And you can read her occasional blogs at majorprogression.wordpress.com. If you have an idea for an In My Backyard, email us at willagstaff@illinois.edu or call us at 217-333-7300.
Support comes from Taylor & Martin Auctions, which is holding an auction of over 100 pieces of large late-model ag equipment from John Deere, Case, and Cat on Tuesday, August 10th at 10 a.m. at Progress City in Decatur, Illinois. Online bidding is available at tmilive.com.